From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Ari Snyder with the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, September 11th, 2025. A new Defense Department report finds that the Army and Navy frequently fail to follow their own policies when personnel make violent threats. As Kevin Miller tells us, the report was sparked by the mass shooting in Lewiston nearly 2 years ago.
The Inspector General's Office at the Defense Department reviewed more than 200 cases of violent threats that were investigated by the Army and Navy in 2023. The investigation found that in more than 40% of those cases, local military law enforcement agencies failed to properly report violent threats to their branches' criminal investigation divisions. The IG also says failure to consistently report such threats up the chain of command, quote, could increase the risk of additional violent incidents by service members, such as what occurred with Sergeant First Class Card. That was a reference to Robert Card, the Army reservist who killed 18 people in Lewiston in October 2023. The report also notes that the Army, Navy, and Air Force do not explicitly require commanders to report when a service member makes violent threats against civilians or non-governmental employees, although many do. Leaders of the military branches agreed to change those policies in response to the findings. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Kevin Miller.
Maine political leaders from both sides of the aisle are speaking out against Wednesday's assassination of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk, a close ally of President Donald Trump. Kirk, 31, was shot and killed at a Utah college event. Republican leaders in the state legislature said in a joint statement that the country has seen too much political violence and denounced anyone who celebrates it. Democratic Congressman Jared Golden said, quote, "If someone can be shot for views you detest, they can be shot for views you hold dear. That's why a free nation cannot tolerate political violence." Governor Janet Mills, following the president's directive, ordered flags lowered until September 14th. In a statement, she said she was horrified by what happened to Kirk. Downeast Community Partners says it's closing its maternal and child health program at the end of September after the state did not renew its contract. Jen Winter is one of four nurses who work for the program, which provides in-home support to roughly 100 families a month before and after childbirth. She says their caseloads will be absorbed by state public health nurses already working in the area.
The caseloads are just going to be magnified, and I just don't see how they're going to be able to focus on all their public health things that they need to do along with these additional families.
The Maine Center for Disease Control says there will be no loss of services. The agency says it's been able to grow the number of public health nurses from a dozen to more than 40. Activists in Portland are raising the pressure on cruise ships to limit emissions and discharge while in port. The group Portland Cruise Control wants the city to ban so-called scrubber wash. That's the often untreated discharge from systems that remove contaminants from marine engine exhaust. Joanne Lochtov helped create the group. She says there needs to be more education about the harm that scrubber wash poses to people and the environment.
Because it's a very specific type of pollution that affects our air and our water.
The Federal Environmental Protection Agency oversees scrubber wash and has introduced a law that regulates vessel discharge into U.S. waters. The U.S. Census released additional data today from a 2024 survey on labor markets, personal income, and health insurance coverage. James Myall, an economist with the Maine Center for Economic Policy, said the state's strong labor market stood out as a bright spot, with median individual earnings increasing by 5%.
Folks who are able to work and are able to take advantage of the strong labor market did pretty well.
Myall says household incomes kept pace with inflation nationally, but he says rental costs and poverty rates are still too high. Timber harvesters and haulers are the backbone of Maine's $8 billion forest products industry, but the most forested state in the country is losing loggers fast. Some are aging out of the profession, others are just getting out. But as Nora Sachs reports, efforts are underway to buck that trend and cut a new trail for the next generation of loggers.
It's early September, and 18-year-old Noah Crummett is deep in a woodlot in Hinckley, operating the joystick of a feller buncher, a tank-like machine with a burly circular saw that, as its name implies, grabs, fells, and bunches trees into piles.
Don to Noah. Noah on five.
Yeah, Don, I got you.
Go ahead and shut the saw off and find a stump to stop it.
Crummett is a student in the Mechanized Logging Operations and Forest Trucking Program, hosted at Kennebec Valley Community College. The tuition is free, paid for by a federal Department of Labor grant. Following his instructor's orders, Crummett, who is lanky and soft-spoken, climbs down out of the climate-controlled and iPad-equipped cab.
It's kind of like flying an airplane, I guess, to me, because there's a lot going on. It's kind of like an excavator, but there's a couple more buttons that you need to keep track of.
In just 20 weeks, Crummett and the 14 other students in this training certificate program learn how to operate high-tech logging equipment, earn their commercial driver's license, and get a firm foundation in wood products. Instructor Donald Burr, who worked as a commercial feller buncher operator for more than 20 years, says logging is more than just maneuvering sophisticated machinery.
You need to be able to look at a tree before you touch it and going, this is what I'm going to do with it, and then make the hydraulics, the booms or whatever, the saw or whatever, and go and make that happen.
Providing this kind of supportive and specialized training to the next generation of loggers is the point of this program. And it comes at a critical time for the industry, which is dealing with substantial attrition.
There's a huge wave coming in the business, and you know, we're trying really, really hard to attract and recruit new people.
Dana Duran is the director of the nonprofit Professional Logging Contractors of the Northeast, which helped launch this program 9 years ago. According to a 2021 University of Southern Maine study, the state is losing about 200 loggers every year. Duran says the last decade has been tough on Maine's forest products industry.
You've had loss of markets, you've had decline of pulp and paper, you've had decline of sawmills, and you had an increase in cost.
He estimates that in just the last 5 years, 40% of the state's logging capacity has vanished. It's a far cry from the salad days of the 1980s, says Andy Irish.
There was hundreds of people cutting wood. Mm-hmm. Real small companies with one cable skidder or two cable skidders, or maybe one old wheeler truck. I mean, just hundreds of them everywhere.
Irish founded Irish Family Logging in Oxford County more than 40 years ago. He says that to survive, the company, now based in Rumford, has had to embrace newer, more efficient timber harvesting technology and the steep costs that come with it.
And everything we buy costs at least $500,000, and most of it $7,000.
Which means, says his son and co-owner Jason Irish, that nowadays you need $1.5 to $2 million just to go into business. And having enough capital is a big barrier to breaking into the industry.
Bank ain't going to give a normal person $1.5 million to get started. So there's not that nowadays. You have to have somebody that can back you, or that you're not going to have, you know, you're not going to have a new logger go out.
Another challenge is on-the-job training, which for many employers is cost prohibitive.
10 years ago, we figured it cost about $100,000 to train an individual. And that's like lost production, that's broken things.
Tom Cushman of Maine Custom Woodlands in Durham says even if companies like his could afford it, these days it's hard to justify investing that much in young, green employees who may switch to excavation, trucking, or other better-paying jobs in industries that require similar skill sets.
The workforce, we have a lot of people that jump around a lot. They're not focused on making a living or having a career.
Many in today's logging industry say the pressing labor shortage is not going to be fixed through high school vocational programs either. Because child labor laws prohibit minors from operating hazardous equipment, the handful of forestry programs left are limited to teaching more traditional timber harvesting techniques, like chainsaws, and tend to focus on soft skills, which is why the one-of-a-kind, community college-based mechanized logging training program is seen as a good option for those who are serious about a career in the woods, especially for those who don't have a background in it, like student Noah Crummett. Inside the cab of the feller buncher, he tells me,
my mom really encouraged me to get into it because she said, I mean, it's free and it's hands-on and it sounds just like what you wanted to do. My dad's pretty jealous. He's an electrician, so.
Over the last 8 years, around 100 people have graduated from this program, and about 60% remain employed in the industry. Those numbers aren't nearly high enough to solve Maine's logger crisis. But for would-be loggers like Crummett, the program is a sturdy path to an entry-level logging job with a starting salary of $50,000 to $60,000. And something else that in this economy is even harder to come by: guaranteed job security. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nora Sachs.
A group of Maine Republican lawmakers are asking the Trump administration to abandon all Gulf of Maine offshore wind leases. Molly Yanking has more.
In their letter, the Maine lawmakers urge Washington to revoke four leases awarded last year, to cancel a scheduled bottom trawl survey, and to terminate the lease for an existing pilot program called the Maine Research Array. They also call for a comprehensive review of existing national offshore wind policies. Representative Reagan Paul of Winterport called floating offshore wind too experimental, too costly, and too disruptive to bear for Maine. The letter authors cite high electricity prices and protection of fishing industry jobs as the reasons to end offshore wind projects. The governor's energy office says Maine's high rates are tied to the grid's reliance on natural gas. Natural gas prices can fluctuate based on national and international events that affect supply. Advocates say developing local sources of alternative energy will stabilize prices. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Molly Enking.
An Angolan soccer player arrested by ICE in Maine last month has been denied bond. His lawyer says it's part of an unprecedented move by the federal government to enforce mandatory detention for certain immigrants. Malunda Destino entered the country without authorization several years ago and is pursuing an asylum claim. His lawyer, David Spitzer, says an immigration judge today declined to consider the merits of his bond request, citing a recent decision from the Board of Immigration Appeals that immigration judges lack the authority to grant bond to people who entered the country without authorization.
They're planning to pick up, potentially hundreds of thousands of people in Malunda's situation and deprive them of any opportunity to seek release.
Spitzer says the next step is asking a federal judge to order his release through a habeas corpus petition. Destino is currently being detained at a prison in Berlin, New Hampshire. Maine's minimum wage will increase to over $15 an hour next year. Maddie Smith has more.
The Maine Department of Labor announced today that the state minimum wage will increase from $14.65 to $15.10 an hour. The state is required to make annual adjustments to its minimum wage based on the cost of living index for the Northeast region. That measure has risen by just over 3% in the last 2 years, which will trigger the increase of 45 cents. The new wage for tipped workers will go to $7.55 an hour. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Maddie Smith.
And now it's time for Maine's Political Pulse, our regular look at government and politics. I'm joined by Maine Public's political correspondent Steve Missler and Kevin Miller. Today, we're talking about the Senate race in Maine, as more and more Democrats announce bids to try to take on Republican Senator Susan Collins next year. Steve, so far, 8 Democrats have filed to run against Collins, but a 9th appears closer to getting in the race. That's Governor Janet Mills. What's the latest on her possible candidacy?
Well, Ari, the governor still has not made any definitive decisions about running, but this week she ramped up her public appearances, including a 3-stop tour in Kennebec County that looked conspicuously like campaign barnstorming. She met with local officials, business leaders, and took questions from the press. And at each stop, the governor sent the strongest signal yet that she'll get in the race, criticizing President Trump and the Republican-led Congress for an array of policies and suggesting that she might want to do something about it.
There's some very disturbing things going on every day, more and more so. And so I'm thinking about that every day because you want to be able to solve problems. And there are a lot of problems.
So those comments are significant, Ari, because when Mills has been asked about running for the Senate before, she's sounded less committed. And when I talked to her over the summer, she struck me as pretty reluctant to get into the contest, to be honest. So this, along with the increased public event schedule, marks a change from just a few weeks ago.
Right. And we already know that national Democrats have been trying to recruit Mills as a candidate. And Kevin, we also know that another candidate, newcomer Graham Plattner, has been trying to make the case that it's time for a new generation of leaders.
Graham Plattner made a big splash when he entered the race in mid-August. And he received, I'd say, an extra boost on Labor Day when he shared a stage in Portland with Senator Bernie Sanders. And there were more than 6,000 people there that day with lots of media, so this was a big platform for him. Plattner just seems to have tapped into this really big vein right now of frustration and anger among many Democrats, and not just with Trump and Collins, obviously, but with their own party. And, you know, he's brusque, he's impolitic, he uses profanity at times, and he's really positioning himself as the anti-establishment candidate. And it's clearly really early. The primary is still nine months away. But right now, there's still quite a bit of buzz around Plattner.
And I'll just add real quick that Plattner in particular has been the most aggressive about challenging Mills. I mean, she's not officially a candidate, but he's sure acting like she is.
Yeah, so how does that show up on the trail?
Well, take this week. I mean, Mills was asked if Senator Collins bears any blame for what she says is the disturbing news coming out of the Trump administration and the Republican-controlled Congress. And the governor said, quote, "She's in a tough position. I appreciate everything she is doing," end quote. Well, that's not an argument for challenging Collins, and it definitely wasn't what Collins' detractors wanted to hear from Governor Mills. It was, however, right in the Plattner campaign's wheelhouse. He quickly issued a statement afterwards saying, quote, "I do not appreciate everything that Susan Collins is doing," end quote. And then the reports came out that Collins was delighted at the governor's comments, saying, quote, "The governor and I have always had a good relationship," end quote. And then Plattner had a response to that too, saying, quote, "Susan Collins and I have never had a good relationship."
So, Kevin, that forced Mills to defend herself the next day, right? And what was her explanation for letting Collins off the hook?
Well, she said she has a good relationship with all four members of the congressional delegation, including Collins, and that she's proud of that because as governor, she needs to work with all of them. That said, Governor Mills said she had, quote, "many serious disagreements with Senator Collins." But at the same time, you know, Governor Mills said those conversations about Senator Collins and her disagreements, they're for another day. Which is presumably when she enters the race, if she does. And, you know, once that happens, it's just impossible for her relationship with Collins not to change and for pretty much everything that she does as governor to be reviewed through her race for Senate as well.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting about this Mills-Plattner dynamic is where both candidates are coming from. You know, Mills is an old school politician with lots of governing and political experience. And she knows the trade-offs and the risks that come with that. And that's one of the reasons why National Democrats think she has the best chance to defeat Collins. And another reason, of course, is that she's won two statewide races. But Plattner is coming at this from a completely different angle. His campaign seems to be banking on the idea that the Democratic primary electorate wants scrappy candidates who ditch poll-tested messaging and favor blunt talk. And as Kevin mentioned, occasionally sprinkled with profanity. And that's what he's embodied. He's mainlining anti-establishment grievances, expressing them in pithy, declarative statements, and broadcasting it all in voters' apparent medium of choice, social media. It's quite a contrast to the types of campaigns we've seen in Maine before, including from Governor Mills.
Okay, so you also mentioned that there are eight candidates in the Democratic primary, possibly a ninth if Mills does get in. Kevin, what are you seeing from the rest of the field, including from newcomer Dan Kleben?
Yeah, so folks may not know Dan Kleben's name, but anyone remotely familiar with Maine's huge craft beer industry will certainly know his company, Maine Beer Company. So far, he's been emphasizing that experience as a small business owner who built this now very successful brewery with his brother more than 15 years ago. And he's accusing not just Senator Collins and President Trump, but also party elite Democrats in D.C. of essentially leaving behind working Mainers. You know, his name has been out there for many months as a potential candidate, but I suspect that coming after Plattner's, like I said, pretty splashy entrance, he might not have gotten as much of a buzz as he might have before Plattner got into the race.
And there were some early reports that Kleben wasn't committed to staying in the race if Mills does decide to run. But Kevin, that's not what he told you recently, right?
He said he's 100% committed to the race.
We're going to go 110%. I think, again, at the end of the day, I think we have the profile of, you know, again, small business owner, not a career politician, pragmatic politics. We can't be purist in our politics. We have to be pragmatic. And I think that I'm the kind of candidate that can finally bring Susan Collins down.
And I have to mention another candidate who's really been out there for many months now, and that's Jordan Wood from Bristol. He's young and worked in progressive politics in D.C. for years. And Jordan has held, I'd say, coming up on a dozen town halls all over the state right now, plus a bunch more informal meet and greets at breweries and other places. He's raised more than $2 million, according to his campaign, and that's impressive for someone who really had no real name recognition before entering the race. What he says is, like Plattner and Kleben, he's going to stay in the race regardless of what Mills does.
And that was Maine Public's political correspondents Kevin Miller and Steve Missler. You can also read our Pulse newsletter. You can find a link to subscribe at mainepublic.org/pulse. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 tomorrow morning, chess. I'm Ari Snyder. Thanks for listening.